Israeli soldiers have entered the Shifa hospital in Gaza.
The troops can be seen within the hospital areas. So it's getting more and more close to our building. We don't know what they want exactly. We don't know what's the end point of this, what they need exactly from us.
Plus, hoping to avert a crisis, President Biden meets with President Xi.
Biden said earlier in the day he hopes the meeting will help improve relations under strain between the two superpowers.
And later, new Israeli media regulations are put to the test. We get the latest from Ukraine, and Christmas is canceled. Today is Wednesday, November 15th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Israeli forces have entered Gaza's Shifa Hospital on Wednesday. Israel claims that Hamas is using hospitals and other civilian institutions as command centers. And U.S. National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby told reporters that Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad members operate a command and control node from Shifa and use tunnels underneath it to support their military operations and hold hostages. Those allegations come amid heartbreaking pictures of people in Gaza with little food, water, and electricity being shown around the world. The AP's Charles de la Desma has more.
Israeli forces are raiding Gaza's largest hospital, where hundreds of patients, including newborns, have been stranded with dwindling supplies and no electricity. 2.5 weeks after sending tanks and ground troops into northern Gaza, Israeli forces entered Shifa Hospital early Wednesday, claiming Hamas operates out of it. Mohammed Zakout, the director of hospitals in Gaza, says tanks were inside the medical compound and that soldiers had entered buildings, including the emergency and surgery departments, which house intensive care units. The hospital's also at the heart of clashing narratives over who is to blame for the thousands of deaths and widespread destruction in the besieged territory. Israel accuses Hamas of using Palestinians as human shields, while Palestinians and rights groups say Israel has recklessly endangered civilians. I'm Charles de la Desma.
Israeli officials do say that medical teams accompanied soldiers inside the hospital and brought medical supplies, baby food, and incubators. Additionally, an anonymous Israeli source says that weapons and terror infrastructure were found inside the hospital. This cannot yet be verified by VOA, and Israel has not made an official statement or released any visual evidence. Dr. Ahmed El Mokahalalati is inside the Shifa Hospital, where the scene is predictably chaotic. He says Israeli soldiers are only a few meters away.
The Israeli forces are now within the hospital building. They have been moving between the buildings where the troops can be seen within the hospital areas. So it's getting more and more close to our building. We don't know what they want exactly. We don't know what's the end point of this, what they need exactly from us happening. So they entered to the surgical facility basement floor, and they went to the dialysis unit in front of that. And so they are moving now. There is continuous shooting and firing outside the hospital or inside. We don't know exactly, but like within the area. The tanks are continuously moving within the hospital area. Again, today, with the whole hospital is totally, like, let me say, in a way, handicapped. Like, no one is operating, no one is seeing anyone. It's like all waiting for what's the end point of this one. Are we going to survive this moment or not? We're unable to perform anything. We're all waiting for the Israeli attack either to settle down or just to come to an end. Because we didn't know what they need exactly.
That's Dr. Ahmed El Mokahalalati, a surgeon at Shifa Hospital in Gaza. Dr. Mokahalalati says Israel had warned the hospital administration in advance of the raid, but staff did not know how it would be carried out. The fate of Shifa, Gaza's biggest hospital, has become a focus of international alarm because of worsening conditions with fuel, medicine, food, and water in ever shorter supply. People began digging a mass grave inside the complex on Tuesday to bury around 100 bodies of patients that had started decomposing. Three newborns died after they had to be moved from incubators to ordinary beds. The United States wants to prevent the conflict from becoming a wider regional war. However, attacks from Iranian-backed militants have not let up, with a multi-rocket attack coming within half a kilometer of an American base in eastern Syria on Tuesday. The U.S. says deterrence is working with Iran, but is it enough to stop the barrage of drones and rockets? VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has the details.
This video shows the latest U.S. attack against a training facility used by Iran's military and its proxies in eastern Syria. U.S. fighter jets struck the training center and this safe house Sunday in response to attacks on U.S. forces. Defense officials tell VOA Iranian-backed militants have attacked U.S. troops in Iraq and Syria at least 56 times in less than a month, with at least five attacks coming after the Sunday strikes. Pentagon Deputy Press Secretary Sabrina Singh.
Is deterrence working? We feel that it is. We have not seen this war spread into a wider regional conflict. The strikes that we are taking is to signal and to message very strongly to Iran and their affiliated groups to stop. That is the purpose of those strikes.
Getting the message, because they keep striking.
I understand that, but again, I think we are being very deliberate on how we, and when we conduct our strikes against these groups, and I think that Iran is certainly seeing that message.
More than 50 Americans suffered minor injuries or traumatic brain injuries from the attacks before returning to duty, officials say. A bipartisan group of senators telling reporters Tuesday the U.S. is lucky that no Americans have died from the attacks, and calling for a stronger response against Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC. Senator Lindsey Graham.
If Iran continues to threaten our troops in Syria and Iraq, the right response militarily would be, in my view, to hit the IRGC training bases and infrastructure inside of Iran.
They have never doubted our capabilities. On occasion, they have doubted our will.
Retired General Frank McKenzie, the former commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East, tells VOA the message America sent by its reduction of forces in the region has left Iran emboldened.
Their primary goal remains the ejection of the United States from the region, and that's the reason these attacks are spiking up.
And two defense officials now confirming to VOA that the U.S. was indeed very lucky during an attack last month at Erbil Air Base. A drone crashed into barracks housing U.S. troops. It failed to detonate, but one official told me had the drone exploded, several troops could have been injured or killed. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Israel has passed new regulations that allow the state to shut down any news outlet it sees as harming national security. And this past weekend, the cabinet voted to shut down the Lebanese pro-Hezbollah Al-Mayadeen's office in Israel. For a closer look at the new rules, I'm joined by Jessica Jarit, VOA's Press Freedom Editor.
Israel, on October 20th, they passed as part of emergency measures in their response to the October 7 terror attack, a law that lets them temporarily close any news outlet that they deem to be harming national security or producing propaganda for Hamas or for Hezbollah or any of their other sort of perceived enemies.
And who makes that decision?
The Israeli Security Council have made this decision, and it's just part of their wider parliamentary emergency measures in response to the war.
It does kind of make sense, doesn't it, that a government would want to, I don't mean silence political opponents, but silence its opponents for existing. These groups, these terrorist organizations, explicitly say they want Israel off the map. They want it gone. So what's the problem?
I think that is the thing. On paper, these issues, these laws, these regulations in any country often seem legitimate and helpful. But then you have to look at it. These news outlets, they're independent. They might have a bias. They might, you know, perceive bias or be more supportive or one or two political factions. But they are still a news outlet, and it should be the news outlets and the audiences deciding where they're getting their information from rather than a government. It's a very slippy slope. As soon as you have a government decide what's propaganda or who is the enemy, they're making that decision for the audience, and press freedom advocates, media advocates, civil liberties societies, they really don't want other people to make that designation on behalf of people, society, media organizations.
Is there opposition to these rules in Israel?
I'm not entirely sure how it's been taken in Israel in terms of like the international community, certainly like the Worldwide Journalism Organizations, the International Federation of Journalists, put out a statement this week calling this a serious blow to media plurality in the region. We're looking at this conflict in terms of there's very few, if any, international broadcasters able to independently go into Gaza and see what's happening. And you have both sides accused of atrocities and potential war crimes. It means that international broadcasters who are going to Israel to see what's happening, they're relying on Palestinian journalists in Gaza, in the West Bank, for that information. We have to keep that information flowing and then have editors and journalists back in the US or across Europe make those decisions about verification and what is or isn't news, and to try to sort of present that as neutrally as possible to our audiences.
Jessica Jarit is VOA's Press Freedom Editor. Jessica, thanks for your analysis today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The latest from Ukraine and the cancellation of Christmas, coming up shortly. Now, hoping to avert a global crisis, U.S. President Joe Biden meets with Chinese leader Xi Jinping for the first time in a year on Wednesday for talks that may ease friction between the two countries on military conflicts, drug trafficking, and artificial intelligence. Reuters' Almond Lee has the story.
Chinese leader Xi Jinping arrived in San Francisco on Tuesday for his first trip to the U.S. in 6 years and a face-to-face meeting with President Joe Biden. Biden said earlier in the day he hopes the meeting will help improve relations under strain between the two superpowers. Xi and Biden have not met since last year, and it will be the first time Biden has hosted Xi on U.S. soil since taking office. The two will also both take part in the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit of world leaders this week. However, just before Xi's landing, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken appeared to take a veiled shot at China, telling ministers of the 21 APEC nations that the U.S. believed in, quote, a region where economies are free to choose their own path, where goods, ideas, people flow lawfully and freely. Blinken didn't mention China by name, but his words appeared to echo previous accusations against China of bullying smaller countries in the Indo-Pacific and trying to undermine the so-called rules-based order. Economic issues are expected to be high on Biden and Xi's agenda. Political analysts say Xi may hope to persuade Biden to ease up on tariffs and controls that have aimed to keep advanced computer chips out of China's hands. Taiwan is another point of contention. Elections there are slated for next year. China will likely look for U.S. assurances it won't encourage pro-independence on the island. Beijing claims democratically governed Taiwan as its own territory. And American officials will likely seek to re-establish military-to-military contact. China severed that following then-House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan last year. The White House earlier said other talking points will include human rights, the Israel-Hamas conflict, and Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
That's Reuters' Almond Lee reporting for us. And now we go from California to Kyiv, where on Wednesday, the Institute for the Study of War confirmed Ukrainian advances in the Kherson and Zaporizhia regions, while Russian forces shelled a residential building in Donetsk. Anna Chernikova has the details.
On November 15th, the Institute for the Study of War confirmed the Ukrainian troops' advances on the Kherson region's left bank to the village of Krynki, which is 30 kilometers northeast of the Kherson region and 2 kilometers from the Dnieper River. The Institute for the Study of War also confirmed advances in the Zaporizhia region, northwest of the village of Verbove, approximately 10 kilometers east of the village of Robotyne. Those advances were also confirmed by geolocated video footage released earlier. The General Staff of Ukraine reported that Ukrainian troops also continue offensive operations in the Melitopol direction in the west of the Zaporizhia region. Meanwhile, several Russian sources claimed that Russian forces repelled Ukrainian attacks near Robotyne, Novofedorivka, which is 15 kilometers northeast of Robotyne, and north and northwest of Verbove. BOA cannot verify this information independently. Overnight, Russian forces shelled a residential building in the city of Selidove in the Donetsk region. As a result of the attack, a large section of the building collapsed. One resident was killed, several injured, and at least one person remains under the rubble. The rescue operation is still ongoing. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Christmas in Bethlehem? That story is next. First, though, this look at the climate crisis. A massive new federal government report says revved-up climate change now permeates Americans' daily lives with harms that are already far-reaching and worsening across every region of the U.S. The National Climate Assessment paints a picture of a country that is warming about 60% faster than the world as a whole, regularly gets smacked with costly weather disasters, and is facing even bigger future problems. Lori London spoke with the lead author of the report, Catherine Cahoe. She's chief scientist of the Nature Conservancy and distinguished professor at Texas Tech University.
The National Climate Assessment shows how climate change is already affecting people in every region of the United States, across every sector, from health to urban areas to transportation. So the report is clear that every tenth of a degree of warming that we avoid matters. Every additional tenth of a degree that it warms carries with it additional costs for us, for our children, for the people and places and things we care about. So that means that everything we do truly does make a difference.
The report said that the United States is warming about 60% faster than the world as a whole, which is concerning in and of itself. There are financial implications to weather disasters and other issues. And you mentioned that it really impacts people's lives. Can you talk more specifically about some of those issues that climate change will have on people's personal well-being?
So we often refer to climate change as global warming. Average temperature of the entire planet is ticking up decade after decade. For you and I, how we're actually experiencing this problem is more through what I think of as global weirding. In other words, wherever we live, our weather extremes are getting weirder. Our heat wave season is beginning earlier in the year and ending later. The heat waves themselves are stronger and much more dangerous and more intense. Heavy rainfall events and flash floods are happening more often. Hurricanes are ramping up from a tropical storm to a category 5 overnight, and wildfires burning so much greater area, choking our air with orange smoke. Across America, a recent survey has asked people, do you feel like your life is being affected by extreme weather? And the vast majority of people are saying, yes, we can see how climate change is literally affecting the air that we and our children are breathing. It is putting the safety of our homes at risk. It is affecting the availability of food and water, even in a country like the United States. And it's having all kinds of domino effects on our supply chain here in the U.S. and around the world.
What about the emotional toll?
Surveys show that most people in the United States are already worried about climate change. And these surveys were done before this last year when we had record-breaking numbers of extremes. You know, back in the 1980s, we used to have $1 billion weather and climate disaster on average every 4 months. Now, we've got one happening every 3 weeks or less. So no wonder people are worried. In the U.S., over two-thirds of people are worried. If you ask young people, it's about 85% of young people are worried. And we see this around the world. Most people are worried. But we don't know what to do. We see these powerful hurricanes and record-breaking heat waves and devastating wildfires, and we think, how is changing my light bulbs and recycling going to fix this? And although changing your light bulbs and recycling are good things to do, the honest truth is those things alone will not fix this. We need change at scale. And to change things at scale, we need people to be using the most powerful force they have, and that is their voice to call for change where we work, where we live, where we study, where we worship, where we bank, and absolutely in the cities and states and the country where we live through voting. All of those actions are incredibly powerful catalysts for change.
That's VOA's Lori London speaking with Catherine Cahoe, chief scientist of the Nature Conservancy and a professor at Texas Tech University. And finally today, a story that could have been taken from the pages of a Dr. Seuss story. The main churches in Bethlehem have agreed to cancel all Christmas celebrations this year in protest of the war in Gaza. The Palestinian city, known as the birthplace of Jesus Christ, will host only religious ceremonies. VOA's Jan Boyschat has more.
Bethlehem will be a somber place this year. The Palestinian city, revered by Christians as the birthplace of Jesus Christ, won't have any celebrations. No lights, no fireworks, and no Christmas tree. The three main churches here, Greek Orthodox, Armenian, and Catholic, have agreed to only conduct religious ceremonies.
This year is going to be totally different. There won't be any lights. We will not have the Christmas tree. We will be mourning those who are being slaughtered in Gaza. There's a deep atmosphere of grief here, and all the churches have decided to only have religious services for Christmas.
Israel declared war after Hamas militants launched a surprise attack in Israel on October 7th. About 1,200 people were killed and 240 others seized and taken into Gaza as hostages. Hamas, a U.S.-designated terrorist group, runs the Gaza Strip. Bethlehem hosts one of the most important Christmas celebrations worldwide. Every year, the city is lit up with thousands of lamps and decorated with one of the biggest Christmas trees in the Holy Land. Since the war between Israel and Hamas broke out on October 7, the churches in Bethlehem host only local believers. Tourists and pilgrims have fled, affecting the city's economy, which relies on its visitors. Sellers like Hadar Hussein agree with the somber moment, but say it's a bit too much not to have even a Christmas tree.
I'm a Muslim, but I don't think this is the correct decision not to set the tree this year. This is a tradition. For centuries we have been doing it. It's a symbol that unites us. I agree it shouldn't be lit, but the tree should be there.
People here in Bethlehem say this is going to be a very sad Christmas for them. Not only because there won't be any kind of celebration here, but also because they feel very sad about what's going on in Gaza. Although most people here are Christians, they say they are Palestinians too, and they are very sad about the killings, the bombings, and the war in Gaza. Wilma Juha is a tourist guide here in Bethlehem.
So we feel sad, but all what we can do here is pray, because the most important thing here is the birth of Jesus and the prayers. So the festivals, it's something like extra. If they canceled it, okay, we are sad. Our kids are sad because they enjoy it. But the most important thing is still here.
The Church of Nativity won't be closed for Christmas. Priests here say this is going to be a very sad Christmas, but service will take place as usual in all churches. Jan Boysha, VOA News, Bethlehem, the West Bank.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.